Now on News Talk, as part of our documentary on News Talk series, producer Brian Gallagher explores the resurgence of interest in the life and times of writer John D. Sheridan in Busy with Words.
That was the thing that I found about Mr. Sheridan. I'm only meeting him for the first time, and I nearly fell in love with the man after one day. It shows you how a child can be affected, like, you know what I mean?
It's very hard to sum your own father up as a person. He wasn't ever harsh. He was an easygoing father.
The book is just, it's wonderful. It's a lovely book.
I was a bit surprised that a famous teacher worked in the school, but it was a good fact to know.
We printed it in 2012 and it just went down a storm. We sold her out instantly, had to go into a reprint. Everybody was reading the book.
If anyone were to ask me off the top of my head to name one person who I can think of as a supreme essayist, it would be John D. Sheridan.
The horses that also pulled the coal carts, they were let out on the shore opposite the school, and they used to leave their droppings, and they would sell them as a fertiliser.
Unlike a lot of boarding schools, food was very plentiful and good, and they had more than adequate portions of things like stewed beef and roast beef and mutton and vegetables, and they got rashers and eggs on church holidays.
I've never dined out on it. It's quite a harmless accolade, and I'll go with it.
So the houses really were probably the first houses in Ireland designed by women to suit women who had working men in the house.
John D. Sheridan was once a very popular Dublin-based writer of humorous essays and well-crafted novels. Drawing on his experiences as a teacher in Eastwall National School in the 1920s and 30s, he wrote the novel Paradise Alley. The book opens with the fictitious school principal, Anthony Domigan, about to retire. Reading this for us is actor and past pupil of the school, Brendan Laird.
He gathered the roll books into the press and locked away for the last time the sloping attendance marks that were like tombstones to the dead days. The monthly return lay on the table in front of him. It was the last one he would ever fill in. From now on, it would be Sullivan's job to collect the signatures of the other teachers, see that all absences were duly entered, and bring the completed form down to the Archdeacon. But the Archdeacon, God help him, hadn't so many monthly returns to sign either. He too, like Anthony himself and the old school, was nearing the end of his tether. They were all finishing up together. St. John's National School, Paradise Alley, Dublin. Roll number 14567, Anthony Domigan, Principal. As he stood up from the table, a great unwieldy seagull lobbed onto the windowsill. Behind it, he could see the nodding masts of the little sailing boats that were anchored outside the school, and behind them, the low grey line of the Bull Wall and the misty outline of Howth Head. Best way to look from Paradise Alley, to lift your eyes and stare into the distance. If you looked straight down, you saw the low sea wall, the muddy foreshore that the tide was so slow in covering, and the yellow cloud that rose from the chugging outflow pipe from the manure factory.
John D. Sheridan cared deeply for his pupils, and this is reflected in his fictitious principal's regrets as he leaves Paradise Alley after a lifetime of teaching there.
Precious little he had done for them. Taught them to sign their names, to add and subtract. Battle of Clontarf 1014, Derby and Nottingham Coalfield. Like signs give plus, unlike signs give minus. It wasn't his fault. He couldn't have fed them and dressed them. He couldn't have taken them out of their two pair backs and given them decent houses. He couldn't have paid for them in secondary schools and put them on for medicine or apprenticed them to accountancy. The children of the poor were unintelligent. They inherited dullness from their parents. So the intelligence testers said. The research educationists. The new psychologists. A fat lot they knew. The children of the poor were as intelligent as anyone else. But they didn't get a dog's chance. They didn't get food or living space or proper rest. They didn't get woolly vests or seaside holidays or cod liver oil or bedtime stories. They became men and women before their time, so that their mental development was telescoped and stunted. His own experience had proved it. he had seen, every 6 years or so, batches of bright, normal children march in from Sister Eta, and he had seen them grow dull and listless as they grew old. They couldn't attend. They couldn't concentrate. They got no chance. Their environment in Paradise Alley was one huge barrier to development, mental, physical, and moral. It made poverty and misery an almost inescapable inheritance.
But although it features hardship and poverty, Paradise Alley is in fact a really entertaining novel. Joe Mooney of the East Wall Historical Society tells how the local community went about republishing the book.
As part of the History Festival, we asked people to donate their old photographs of their school days, and we had an evening here where past pupils spoke. And it was during that event that a local woman, Rita Lestrange, said to us, "Did you ever read a book that was written about the school?" And of course I hadn't. And I said, "Well, was it non-fiction or was it just an account?" And she said, "Oh no, it's a great book. It was John D. Sheridan, he was a teacher here." So of course I went and got the book. I had to order from America. I read the book and it was absolutely extraordinary for two reasons. One, it was a very detailed history of the school, and we knew from local knowledge that a lot of what was in the book was actually based on fact. And the other thing, which is probably even more important in a way, is that it was an absolutely brilliant novel. We couldn't believe that such a great book had been written about our community and just wasn't available. So we looked at reprinting it. A member of the history group who has sadly passed on since then was involved in a not-for-profit publishing company. So I said to her, "Is there any chance that we might be able to bring this book out again?" We printed it in 2012 and it just went down a storm. We sold it out instantly, had to go into a reprint. Everybody was reading the book. But that's the story of how the book was brought back into print. It originally came out in the mid-1940s and it stands the test of time as a great novel. And that was 20 years or so before Strumpet City came out. So it has the claim of being the first work of fiction, the first novel of the 1913 lockout. And again, for that reason, it should be better remembered and better celebrated in Irish literature.
John D. Sheridan, or John D. as he was popularly known, would go on eventually to be a teacher, an essayist, a novelist, a poet, and a newspaper contributor. But who was he, and where did he come from? John Sheridan, the son of John Dee, tells of his father's Donegal background, which features strongly in his writing.
He was born in Glasgow in 1903, but they had come over to here when he was somewhere around 7 or 8, and they lived on the north side of Dublin. Both his mother and father came from Ireland, Donegal, and he really loved that area, and he would generally say that's where he came from. And he loved to go back there, and he was awfully fond of that area.
But despite the Donegal roots, most of John Dee's childhood was spent in Hollybank Road, in the Dublin suburb of Drumcondra, as his son recalls.
"I haven't ever been in that house. He quite often pointed it out to me when we were driving out to the airport. That was Hollybank Road up there where he lived. It seemed to have played quite an important part in his life. He was at that age when things meant a lot to him, and he had spoken about it fairly often afterwards."
John D. Sheridan grew up as historic events like the lockout and the 1916 Rising took place in Dublin. I asked his son if he was influenced by these developments.
"Yes, he would have been, but he was comparatively young at the time. As I say, he was born in 1903, and I suppose young people of the age of he'd have been 12, 15, he'd be much more interested in other things like sports and reading than what was happening then.
But fortunately for us as readers, he was taking in what was going on around him. And like many writers, he would later use his childhood experiences as material for his fiction. First, though, he had to attend school, and his parents sent him to be educated by the Christian Brothers in the well-known O'Connell School. Historian Sean Boyne, who wrote a history of O'Connell pupils who took part in the 1916 Rising, tells of what the school was like at that time.
"It was regarded as a very good school. It had a very fine academic reputation. Every year the brothers would publish a booklet giving examination results, outlining the achievements of their pupils, the scholarships they had been won, and they would also refer to the past pupils who had gone on to university and what they were achieving in the university as well."
So what was the social mix like when John D. Sheridan was a pupil?
"You would have had middle class people going with a view to going on to secondary school and then maybe going some of them going on to university. And then people from the local working class community would have gone there as well.
John D. Sheridan would, in time, become prominent as a writer. But other pupils from the school also came to public attention, as Sean Boyne explains.
You had people like Sean Lamass, who later became Taoiseach, and John A. Costello, who also became Taoiseach, Sean T. O'Kelly. He obviously became President of Ireland afterwards. And of course, it should be remembered that three of the executed leaders of the Rising were former pupils of O'Connell's: Eamon Cant, Sean Houston and Con Colbert.
After secondary school, John D. Sheridan decided to be a teacher. And I asked his son John where he went to be trained.
Patrick's College, which actually was only a couple hundred yards from where he had lived.
St. Patrick's in Drumcondra, which is now part of Dublin City University, has a long history. Katrina Nikasiga explains.
St. Patrick's College is one of the oldest third level educational institutions in Ireland. It was founded in 1875 and it very quickly became one of the leading colleges in terms of initial teacher education. An all-male college until the 1960s, and the female teaching population came over from Carysfort.
Katrina was a pupil and then a teacher in St. Joseph's in East Wall, where John D. Sheridan also taught, and now she's based in St. Pat's, where John D. did his teacher training.
The main characteristics that were kind of imbued in the students, there were four essential ones, that they had to be middle class, religious, show few signs of dissent, and manly. Manly appears to be used quite a lot in teacher reports and stuff like that.
So what would it have been like back then? And how were the manly trainee teachers treated?
From all accounts, the college was run very much along the lines of your typical boarding school, that you were given a number and that number followed you everywhere from your dormitory to the dining hall to lectures and so on. Unlike a lot of boarding schools, food was very plentiful and good, and they had more than adequate portions of things like stewed beef and roast beef and mutton and vegetables, and they got rashers and eggs on church holidays.
It was also a time of political change, as Katrina explains.
When the establishment of the Free State, the Minister for Education directed that Irish be taught in schools for at least an hour a day, and this began what Dermot Verriter calls the Irish Language Crusade, which had a huge impact on college life. John D. entered the college during this phase.
Catholicism was also to the fore in St. Pat's.
Religion would have played a very important role here, and when we were standing out in the quad there, you could see the entrance into the church, and there's also an old bell there that was rang in the mornings to call all the male students to come down for early morning mass.
John D. Sheridan's first novel, Vanishing Spring, was set in Donegal and published in 1935. John D.'s son recalls discussing it with his father.
One that he spoke to him about afterwards, that he actually didn't want me to read because he thought he hadn't written it terribly well. But I was very interested in reading it because when I did, I was able to recognise the area that he was writing about, which was that small village that his mother came from. So even though he didn't say it was Glenfarr, it obviously was Glenfarr.
A decade later, Dublin had replaced Donegal as the main location, when Paradise Alley was published.
It's the one that I liked. It had talked about his time at the East Wall Boys and Ashton School, and I must have read that at a very early age, and then I've read it over a number of times since then. There was this letter I found after he died, that there was some talk to make a film on it, and they had picked as the parish priest this famous Irish-American actor, Barry Fitzgerald. But nothing further came from that, and he didn't talk about that incident afterwards.
Let's look at some of the places that feature in Paradise Alley, with Joe Mooney as our guide.
Yes, we're standing at the school here. We're looking across a blank wall. We're looking across what would be the Port Tunnel. Beyond that would be East Point Business Park. And all around us there's now offices, etc. At the time, we would have been looking at the sea. You literally walked out of the school, there was a road there, and that was the sea wall across the road. If you were sitting in your classroom and looked out the window, you could see Hoat. You could look straight across at Clontarf, and you could look at ships coming in and out of the port. So for the school, at that time, in winter, it would have been a very unpleasant place. You would have been coming to school with the wind howling at you from across the road. You would have been getting splashed by waves if the wind was high, and it would have been very, very cold in the school.
Just around the corner, we visited a street that seen lots of drama.
Okay, we're standing on Merchants Road, and Merchants Road is really important in the story of 1913 and the lockout. Not only for our area, but for the city, because we believe this to be the single largest eviction in the history of Dublin City. These houses behind us were built in 1907 by the Merchants Warehousing Company, and they were built to house their workers. The Merchants Warehousing Company was one of the biggest companies on the docks, and they actually forced their workers to move in here. And the road got the name Compulsory Row. That was the nickname because the workers had to live here and they had to pay rent. So come 1913, when the lockout broke out, the men in there who were members of the Irish Transport and General Workers Union got caught up in the lockout, and the company served eviction notices on them. So as a consequence of that, in December of 1913, a cold, wet day with the wind howling in from the sea, over 60 workers and their families were evicted from the street. The entire street practically was evicted, which, taking in mind wives, children, in-laws, it was somewhere between 200 and 300 people were evicted on this street at Christmas in 1913. To add insult to injury, not only were the men and their families evicted, but scab labour was moved into these houses. The company kept operating throughout the lockout. It brought in scabs to do the jobs of the men that were locked out and on strike, and they moved them into these houses. And as a consequence, for many years afterwards, the road had the new nickname of Scabs Row.
A happier development in housing was initiated by Canon Hall of the nearby Church of Ireland parish of St Barnabas. Canon Hall was appalled by the slum conditions in the area and founded a charitable cooperative to build new homes. Joe Mooney takes up the story.
If you look at these houses today, they're still incredible houses. In 1921, he built 10 of them. The next year, he built 26. In 1924-25, he built 62. And eventually, he built 171 houses in this area. His plans were then taken on board by Dublin City Council, and it inspired the building of the houses in Marino, some of the initial corporation houses built in the city. The houses built by Canon Hall, the St Barnabas Public Utility Housing, were really unique. They were unique in many ways, but particularly unique and probably groundbreaking is he asked the opinion of people what they would like to see a modern house to be. And even more extraordinary, he asked the women what they wanted. And if you look at the houses now, the design is perfect because they had a little hallway, and that was designed so the men could take their boots off before they would walk into the house and drag mud all over it. They had their own toilets and they had a little garden outside. So the houses really were probably the first houses in Ireland designed by women to suit women who had working men in the house.
Actor and broadcaster Des Keogh is a long-time admirer of John D. Sheridan's work, and he tells how he put together a stage show based on his essays.
When I was in the theatre business, I was always looking for material for a show for myself, if you like, a one-man show. So I had this idea of going back and looking up the essays of John Dee, because I used to enjoy them so much. And he had this wonderful way of seeing humour in things. And I was always very keen on humorous material. So I picked out ones that I really thought would have an appeal in the theatre and would be theatrical. So I put this material together anyway and made it into a show. And people enjoyed it because there was an audience there who remembered John Dee very well.
But while John D. Sheridan's way with words made for well-observed humour and polished prose, he worked hard at his craft, as he reveals in his poem Journeyman, read by Des Keogh.
I have been busy with words all my days, trying to learn their strange and unknowable ways, to list and to label the texture and feel of them, to cope with the wild, unpredictable scatter and wheel of them. I spancelled them close in the pound of the mind, with meaning for tether, putting words of a kind in the paddock together. But words of a kind was a blind sort of sorting, for the staidest of words will go on the rampage, cavorting with words of low station, and have truck with damnation. While a word that Dryden thought Riggish may grow in a mere 300 years or so, Vickers, tea party, prune, prism, priggish, for a word is always going somewhere, and you never can tell what direction. This heaven, that hell. So take my advice, little miss, little man, and give words the go-by. Deal with raisins and pears, planks of wood, stocks and shares, or mechanical hairs. Let your norm be
we regret to inform, be warned in time of the floor-pacing blood-sweat of essay or rhyme, for the great disaster of words is that journeymen never master the trick of them, though they live in the thick of them, and at the end of their days no less of their ways than an old mouth at the back of a clay pipe that can say what it wants to say without let or delay, that can bury itself in a pint and say troth, and then wipe the hell of an epigram off with the froth.
East Wall-born Charlie O'Leary's great love was soccer, both as a player, a referee, and perhaps most famously as kit man to the Ireland squad during the Jack Charlton era. Charlie was a pupil in the old East Wall National School when John D. Sheridan taught there, and over 80 years later, he recalls the area.
Well, firstly, I went there as 4-year-old. East Wall at the time, there weren't many houses there. But right along the East Wall Road, the water came all the way down from Anzer Bridge down to where the ships come in now, the dockland down there. The water actually come up. The wall right opposite the school was only about 2 foot high. So, like at the present day, young boys know the registration of cars. Well, we knew the names of the yachts that took part in the yacht racing around there. And we were interested in the yacht racing sitting on the wall in summertime.
Charlie vividly remembers the day his authoritarian teacher, Mr. Sheehan, was replaced by a more affable young teacher, John D. Sheridan.
When you meet two different people, as a child, you have, for instance, Mr. Sheehan, a very strict gentleman, where you're afraid to smile, you're afraid to look crooked, you're afraid to do anything. And all of a sudden, you went into this classroom where this man had a big jolly face, a real homely face, and this is a different atmosphere altogether. That was the thing that I found about Mr. Sheridan. I'm only meeting him for the first time, and I nearly fell in love with the man after one day. It shows you how a child can be affected, like, you know what I mean?
Many years later, Charlie met Joe Mooney and became involved when it was proposed to republish Paradise Alley.
Joe asked me, with a go down. He showed me some old stuff from East Wall, roll calls and the devil knows what. So he brought me down then to one or two functions he had down there, and I was a help to them in certain questions they were asking me, and they researched the book.
Today, East Wall National School is co-educational and known as St. Joseph's. And when Joe Mooney got out the old school roll books, they confirmed Charlie's memories, with John D. Sheridan listed as a teacher there from 1927 to 1932.
So what we have here is, we have the school registration books and we have school roll books from around about the year when John D. Sheridan was here. And what we're looking at here is a school timetable. It's a little bit faded now. You can see John Herlihy, you can see Mr. Duggan, you can see Mr. O'Hagan. And of course here, very clearly, you can see John D. Sheridan's name listed. And if you look at the roll book here, I won't mention any names of the pupils, but you can see it's listed the father's occupation. So you can see on this page here, there's five boys who've just enrolled, and every one of their fathers is listed as a labourer. On the other page, there's another five boys. You can see three of the five are labourers. One is an ex-soldier, and the other one is a shopkeeper. So the fathers would have been loading and unloading material in the warehouses. They would have been working on the quays. A lot of them would have been casual labour. Some weeks you might get a full week's work. Some weeks you might only get a day. So the families would never know from day to day or from week to week how prosperous they would be.
Des Kyo recalls how buying Christmas presents for his parents was easy, thanks to their taste in reading.
My mother and father are great John D. Sheridan fans. And when I was growing up in Burr, I remember at Christmas time, it was always a surefire hit. We bought one of John D.'s collections of essays from my mother and father. This would go down really well. I enjoyed the essays very much also every week in the Irish Independent.
So what was John D.'s peak era of popularity?
I think it would have been the 50s. 50s, 60s, he was extremely popular and we all loved the material of John D.
Drawing on the minor dramas of everyday life, the essays are both funny and insightful. Des Kyo reads from one of the most well-loved pieces, I Know How You Feel.
If this was his first day at school, ma'am, I know how you feel. You dressed him up in his new jersey and pants and you spent most of the morning grooming him. You almost washed his ears away, and you put a shine on his cheeks. You wet his curls and combed them into glory. You hugged him because he looked so lovely, and you cursed all schools because he looked so young. But you brought him, nevertheless, and changed your child into a unit of attendance. If you were a foolish woman, you would have offered to let your house go to pot and to stay with them all day as an unpaid, untrained supernumerary, a highly privileged assistant. But you are a sensible woman, so you turned on your heel and walked away. Not too sensible, however, for you took one look back as you walked up the corridor, and you saw that he was looking back too, with a little lost look, as he went into the classroom to join his regiment. Something happened to your heart then. You told the woman next door over the railings that you didn't know whether you were laughing or crying, but you knew well enough, and she knew you were crying, and you had good reason, for the thing that happened to your heart when you left him will never be put wholly right. A weaker woman might have stood at the window at midday to watch for his coming, but you contented yourself with settling the front room curtains 5 or 6 times, and it was quite by accident that you saw him turn the corner. There wasn't the slightest hurry on him as he walked up the path, the little rascal. All he wanted was his dinner. He might have been years at school for all the excitement he showed, and the little he had to tell had to be dragged out of him. Before he had finished his second helping of pudding, there was a rattle at the letterbox, and he rushed out at once to join his comrades in arms. You dragged him back to rub his face and hands, and you terraced his curls with a wet comb. But all the time he was fighting to be gone, and when he walked out the gate, he didn't as much as look back. You knew then that he was reared and done for. And when you went back into the kitchen again, the baby in the chair was no comfort to you. So you made yourself a nice cup of tea and told yourself not to be silly. After all, it was only for a few short hours. When he came back again in the evening, he would be your very own, and you would have him all to yourself. It was then that you cried, in real earnest, for you knew in your heart and soul that you would never have him again. Not in the old way. He was reared and done for. You thought when you got him first that you would have him forever, but all you had was a loan of him. He will still come to you in his troubles, for he is tethered to your heart, but he will come less frequently as the tether lengthens, until some day it breaks and there is nothing left but the stake. You will still have him morning and evening and on Sundays and holidays, but though he will return as surely as a homing pigeon, you will know that he is merely home on leave. From now on, the world will be his barrack square. And there is nothing you can do about it. I know how you feel.
You're listening to Busy with Words on Documentary on News Talk.
Remember the days of the old schoolyard? We used to laugh a lot. Oh, don't you remember that?
I asked pupils in John Dee's old school what they thought of St. Joseph's famous former teacher.
It's very cool that he worked in this school.
I was a bit surprised that a famous teacher worked in the school, but it was a good fact to know.
I thought it was really cool because I hadn't heard anything like that about the school.
When you look out the window nowadays, you can see cars, buses, the poor tunnel. But when John Dee Sheridan worked there, when you looked out the window, you could just see the sea, Hothead, little horse and carriages.
The horses earned their keep in more ways than one.
The horses that also pulled the coal carts, they were let out on the shore opposite the school, and they used to leave their droppings, and people would go out and collect the droppings, and they would sell them as a fertiliser for people's gardens to grow vegetables.
Those days are long since gone, but today's pupils still enjoy the link to John Dee Sheridan as they read from his poem Dan the Watchman.
Dan the Watchman, from the book called Stirabout Lane by John Dee Sheridan.
Dan doesn't go to bed. He sits in a little wooden hut instead, at the little coke fire, half red, half blue, listening to the elves go woo woo woo, and the town clock strike 2:30.
When the moon sits on top
of the grey church spire, he piled more coke on his red and blue fire. When the old mill pond begins to freeze, he eats his supper of bread and cheese.
I'd like to go out in the middle of the night, when the little coke fire is shining bright, when the flames burn blue and the flames burn red, and everyone else in the world is in bed.
Then I'd sit in a little wooden hut with Dan and drink strong tea from his black billy can.
Continuing the link with books, Norrie Cody, a teacher for many years in St. Joseph's, encourages reading.
We scanned in all the books that we had in the school, we organised them all. We now have this dedicated library, which has a fantastic range of fact and fiction books and teachers' resources and readers and things. The kids have, you know, a library bag so that we can keep the books in good condition. The books, they're allowed to take 3 books at a time.
Norrie remembers the school library being a bit daunting, but tells how that's changed.
All the books used to be covered in brown paper and they were ticketed and you had to apply in advance to get them. Now they love it and it's obviously an extremely pleasant environment. There are lots of tables and cushions and chairs to sit on and read at their leisure.
John D. Sheridan had a strong religious faith and it influenced his writing. His sense of charity and the belief in the brotherhood of mankind meant that his humour was gentle and philosophical. But he still had a sharp eye for the ridiculous, and his essays could be genuinely funny, as Charlie O'Leary testifies.
I don't think we appreciate humour, really, until we read stuff like that. And that's good writing. And you can't finish reading because you're tittering. That's humour to me, anyway. And that's the way I always felt when I picked up him, when he read The Independent. I used to love reading him. A natural humour that he saw in people. He saw the funny side of most things. And I think that's what made his article so good.
But while John D. Sheridan saw the humour in most situations, he also had a sense of righteous anger at the social conditions endured by his pupils, few of whom finished their education. Charlie remembers what happened at the end of primary school, when it was time to sit the primary cert examination.
But the whole class didn't go in for it. They selected a group to go in for it. So she elected, I think it was 14, to go in for, and I was one. I remember my ma, Lord Wester, saying, you go into that room there. All through my school holidays, I was stuck in that room studying, and I passed it. But when we were being presented with a certificate, I was the only one still going to school. All the rest had left.
Having performed his material in public, how would Des Kyo describe John D. Sheridan as an essay writer?
Well, a master. If anyone were to ask me off the top of my head to name one person who I can think of as a supreme essayist, it would be John D. Sheridan. He writes about anything, and I don't know how he did it. Every week comes up with something beautiful, and he has a lovely slant on things which are so accessible to people. Even now, some of them are somewhat dated, but nevertheless, they still have a great appeal.
Most of the pieces were first published in John Dee's weekly newspaper column, and Des Kyo reads from one of them, an essay called Just One Little Word.
I overheard a man discussing cures for the common cold the other day, and he summed up by saying, there's nothing to beat the old ball of malt. And as I listened, I could not help thinking how hard it would be to explain his full meaning to a foreigner. A ball of malt, of course, is a glass of whisky, but owl is untranslatable. Owl can mean a lot of things, but it rarely means old. And even when it means old, it means a dozen other things as well. Owl has 1,000 uses and as many tonal inflections, but you won't find them in the dictionary. You must learn them by experience and by listening to the best speakers. In backbiting and detraction, for example, a well-placed owl may strengthen the libel and put salt in the wound, but not always. Sometimes it softens the charge and brings a smile into it. A ruffian is only a ruffian, but an owl ruffian is usually a character around whom a whole saga of disreputable stories has grown up and in whom the entire neighbourhood takes pride. Again, an owl divil may be a decent owl fella in his own way, but an owl blackguard
is beyond redemption. To ask, how is the rheumatism, is one thing, but you are on an altogether different footing with someone to whom you can say, how is the rheumatism? I could give 1,000 examples, but the secret would still be a secret. For unless you were born to the idiom, you will never master it. And every time you feel that you are making a little headway, you will come up against some fresh use of owl that will make you despair. Thus, a young man who talks too much is an owl blather, whilst a really old man may be an owl cod, and a child just learning to walk is an owl dolt. When I was growing up in Dublin, a boy would speak of his father as me owl fella, an expression which hid varying amounts of tenderness, fear, respect, affection, resentment, and conditional loyalty. Owl can be full of tenderness and sentiment. It can tell a love story or a life story. One snowy evening many years ago, I walked down a city street behind two aging men who were coming home from work. They walked in silence, and the snow deadened all our footsteps. Just before they separated, one of them said, "Dowl Mutt is not well." There was no reply. Each of them went his own way, and I was left to the silence of the snow. For once, I can't translate. One man said that his wife was not well, but he said more than that. He hinted that she would never be better. He linked the past with the present. He went back to his courtship days and echoed an "I will" that was 40 years old. We Irish are supposed to wear our hearts on our sleeves, but we don't. We are terribly afraid of our hearts, and the old Gaelic reticence is still strong in us. We hide our deepest feelings and give our emotions no words. We can coin mighty compliments when we speak from the head, but when we speak from the heart, we are tongue-tied. However, we manage to get along. We have one little word that sees us through all our emotional difficulties. When thou'r tongue lets us down.
Towards the end of Paradise Alley, the Second World War affects the characters. Knowing how John D. Sheridan's work was influenced by events in East Wall, Joan Mooney's curiosity was aroused.
There's a piece in it where a prominent character dies as a member of the RAF. And that was something that baffled us because we knew from reading the book up to that point, practically every little incident in the book, they all actually happened. So when we got to the bit about the RAF man dying, we thought, this has to be accurate. There has to be something in the story. But we never found it until long after the book was published. And then somebody sent us a newspaper article that really put it into context. And we believe that refers to a man who was called George Raymond Hall.
George Hall was the son of East Wall's Canon Hall, the Protestant minister who built the houses at St. Barnabas's Park.
John D. Sheridan certainly would have known him, so we would be fairly certain that the fictional character in Paradise Alley, who dies as a member of the RAF, is based on George Raymond Hall. And again, it just proves how accurate this piece of fiction is in telling a story that is mostly true.
In Paradise Alley, the principal, Anthony Domigan, taught in East Wall but lived in Clontarf. In reality, John D. Sheridan lived in Glasnevin. Twins Paul and Colin Murphy remember him as a neighbour and recall appearing as children in one of his essays.
As a very young kid, I'd say somewhere between 4 and 8, my twin brother and I got to meet John D. Sheridan occasionally when we were visiting our grandfather on the Rise in Glasnevin.
There was an article in The Independent where he talked about his dog. The name of the article was The Uppity Dog, and basically that his dog was a bit of a snob and would only abide by certain class of people coming into his garden.
I guess one of my parents, I'm sure my dad, might have remarked to John D that the dog got included in our night prayers.
At the end of the article, we get a mention. He refers to the twins and how they would pray for his dog every night.
It's quite clear that the twins referred to were my brother Colin and myself.
And I remember the prayer went something like, God bless Papa and Granny and Daddy and Mammy and A, B, C and D and the dog whose name was Fido or something like that.
So what was it like to be immortalised in a John D. Sheridan essay?
It's probably won't happen again anyway. His writing, I think, represented a style that was of its time.
I've never dined out on it. It's quite a harmless accolade, and I'll go with it.
John D. Sheridan worked for the Educational Company of Ireland, which didn't boost his son's popularity in school.
He wrote a lot of school books, Irish, maths, English, geography, everything. As a result, some of the other schoolmates gave me a fairly hard time for that.
So how was it generally to have a famous father?
I found it much more awkward than that. People would not regard me as me, but they would regard me as his son. I got great enjoyment out of one time when I was at university introducing him as my father.
And what was he like as a parent?
It's very hard to sum your own father up as a person. He was always there, and I spoke to him quite often. He wasn't ever harsh. He was an easygoing father. We were all fairly young, and he used to call us Morsel 1, 2 and 3. I'd often meet people who would ask me whether I was Morsel 1, 2 or 3. So, no, I didn't mind. Like, obviously, you know, when you're at that age, you certainly don't think of your father as being a very famous man. He is just somebody who you might be kicking football with in the back garden or something.
For many years, John D. Sheridan's newspaper articles were popular, and he covered a huge spectrum of subjects, from poodles to night watchmen, from Christmas puddings to the decline of the overcoat. Eventually, though, his style went out of fashion, and in 1980, the author died. Des Kyo reads the poem Funeral from John Dee's poetry collection Joe's No Saint.
A hearse with dim, anemic lights and hired plumes of sorrow will bring him to the church tonight and to the grave tomorrow. I'm sorry for your trouble, ma'am. I'm sorry for your trouble. I should have backed the thing myself. I hear that Mick brought off the double. This poor clay was given life on such and such a day and died on such another. Thus is a life's long history compressed on the brass plate of an oak chest. Earth to earth, flesh to the sod, breath to the winds, and the soul to God.
So what was it like for the people of East Wall when Paradise Alley was republished locally?
I think when the book came out, there was an amazing feeling because had so much truth in it. It captured so much of the attitude of the people.
It was just a lovely nostalgic trip down memory lane for a lot of people. We even have still in the community one or two people who remember John D. Sheridan teaching in school.
It captured what the area was like, how the area changed with the building of the corporation houses. All that was captured in it.
It was just a wonderful opportunity to bring that literature out into the public domain. It had been forgotten for so long, and to have local people reading it and not only familiarising themselves with the work of John D. Sheridan, but getting a glimpse into the school life that their grandparents or parents might have had. The book is just, it's wonderful. It's a lovely book.
So really, as well as being a great read, as well as the pride of finding this great piece of literature is actually about your community, it also told people an important piece of their own history. And I think it was great.
For some people, John D. Sheridan will be associated with his novels, particularly Paradise Alley. For Charlie O'Leary, however, it's the humorous essays that deserve to be remembered.
We talk about Joyce and we talk about O'Casey and all, and we don't let people forget about them. What's the difference between O'Casey speaks about tragedy? This other man is joviality, humour. And why can't we boast that this man came from East Wall, from our school, that he was there to teach us? He came from the north end of Ireland, Donegal. And he comes along then and he gets all the Dublinese stuff into it and he mixes it together for humour. Now that takes some doing. And that we should be boastful about that. And in my opinion, we can't do enough to bring the likes of the John Desmond Sheridan back to the forefront.
Brendan Laird reads from the closing chapter of Paradise Alley.
The electricity depot at the Pigeon House glowed with light, and the thudding of its sleepless dynamos carried across the water to him. A boat hooted as it slid down the river. There was no sleep for Paradise Alley. All night long, wagons would clank and rattle, bullocks would come padding out from railway sidings in the small hours. Out of breath, engines would whistle in the dawn. Paradise Alley and places like it were maids of all work to the city, and the port that brought salaries to Rathmines and Donnybrook was their tireless taskmaster. During his 40 years in Paradise Alley, he had had little opportunity of teaching the things that really mattered. Now he was going to begin where he had left off. He was going to teach Paradise Alley not just the things that would help it earn a living, but the things that would help it to live. The pupils would come, billiards and football would bring them, and it was up to him to hold them. And he felt reasonably sure that he could hold them, not because of anything in himself, but because of something in them, something that poverty and undernourishment and bad smells could not kill. He had always believed in Paradise Alley, and now, more than ever, he was prepared to back it against all the world.
Busy with Words was produced and edited by Brian Gallagher. Our thanks to all those who took part in the project. This programme was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee.